Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we have a wonderful discussing episode, and we're discussing The Changeling by... Now, which order of precedence shall I go for the two authors involved, shall I say, by Thomas Middleton and William Rowley, or shall I say by William Rowley and Thomas Middleton? Discuss, because it's one of the things about collaborative plays is, what order of precedence? Thomas Middleton might be a little more well-known than William Rowley, but I at this stage, certainly as far as we are concerned as a podcast and our exploring sessions, we don't really know much. We haven't really explored Rowley very much, so I couldn't comment whether it's the superior or inferior playwright yet. The common consensus is that Thomas Middleton is the bee's knees and William Rowley is some guy. But let's test that proposition with my guest, who is producing The Changeling later this year at time of recording. And so my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, I'm Ricky Dukes. I'm the artistic director of Lazarus Theatre Company. And at the moment, my purpose in life is Arts Council funding. Generally, as a theatre company, we produce early modern plays as well as, we're basically a classics company. But of course, classics means anything really from early Greek drama through to, I think still the definition is 1951. So that's quite a broad spectrum of work. As you say, yes, we're doing a production of The Changeling in September, October at Southwark Playhouse in London.
Of course, we have chatted before. We actually chatted in person. Rather, we're recording this via this new, I say new, this intermediary thing called Zoom. But we did actually have a chat previously about, I think specifically we were talking about Edward II, and other things, so that you can listen back to some of the earlier productions that Lazarus have produced that are within our wheelhouse. And so that is further down the podcast list, and hopefully there'll be a link in the show description, unless I forget to put it there. So, The Changeling. I was going to say, what is the plot? But I think perhaps the better question is, what are the plots?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And that's something which, so I suppose it's useful for listeners, just to put it in sort of context, really. Because we're about sort of a quarter of the way into our kind of discovery process. So essentially, one thing we do as a company with most plays is try and treat them as brand new plays. So what it helps us do, I think, as theatre makers is to not assume anything, not to continue with the baggage, particularly with more sort of well-known and more often produced plays. It forces us to look at it again. But in this case, it's really, really useful because actually to most people working on the show, including myself, actually it is brand new in that we don't really know much of the baggage about Thomas Middleton and Rowley and the play. We're picking that up as we're going along. But we're really sort of at the really exciting part of the investigation of the thing, because I think it's really important that all the theatre makers know as much as possible about playwrights and the context in which it's written, because that's just useful information in performance. Either actors can use that or not, but just getting a grounding of where we are. So, yes, we're really at the start of it. So, there's these plots. And actually, I think there's two plots, three worlds, which might really, really might confuse people. But essentially the first plot is the castle plot. And that focuses really on a character called Beatrice Joanna. It's set in Alicante in Spain. And she lives inside this castle with her dad, which we find out, I think it's about a quarter of the way to the play. Actually, they were at war, but there's some sort of peace treaty that's gone on, so that we're not fighting at the moment. So this sort of fortress is sort of sitting there redundant. Anyway, she's betrothed to a chap called Alonso, which she sort of seems, Beatrice Joanna at the beginning of the play seems to be fine with, I suppose, at best. But in a chance meeting at a chapel at the beginning of the play, she meets another chap called Alcimero, who seems to take her breath away and vice versa as well. He seems to be all of a sudden a chap that's not particularly romantic or very windswept, seems to be completely taken with Beatrice Joanna. Anyway, they end up going back into the castle together. And Beatrice Joanna finds herself in a bit of a conundrum, to put it lightly, a bit of a predicament, where she doesn't want Alonso, the man that she's betrothed to. She now wants Alsemero. So she cooks up a plan of trying to get rid of Alonso. But so she doesn't incriminate Alsemero, she employs Deflores, who is her father's servant, who is this, and she calls him a dog face. And apparently his face resembles a toad pool. She's not particularly positive about his outward appearance, to say the least. She's actually vile to him. And he haunts her in some very sort of creepy, obsessive way. He's always there. He's madly obsessed with her. Deflores is of Beatrice Joanna. Anyway, so she cucks up this plan that Deflores, if he kills Alonso, she can get rid of two birds with one stone, get rid of Deflores, get rid of the suitor she doesn't want, and she can marry Alsemero and they live happily ever after. But of course, this is a Jacobean tragedy or thriller, we're putting a sort of slant onto it. So that happens. Deflores does kill Alonso, and in the process chops his finger off, which we're understanding is quite a sort of in-your-face metaphor for castration, which is marvelous, because as soon as you start reading the play with castration in mind, it literally flings it at you. Anyway, they come up with, on the wedding night of Beatrice and Alsemero, we find out that Alsemero has this sort of box of tricks, if you like, which effectively are liquids, waters that can test if a woman is honest and if she's a virgin. Beatrice Joanna, thinking on her feet, ends up replacing herself with her waiting woman, Diophanta, who ends up having the first night of the wedding with Alsemero. And as sort of punishment for that, although she sort of thinly veils it as a kind of, we can't let this woman talk, Deflores and Beatrice Joanna burn Diophanta alive. We're still working out how we do that on stage. And so that happens. And then in the end, it's all revealed what's happened. And spoiler alert for anyone thinking about coming along, Deflores kills himself and Beatrice Joanna kills herself as well. And then there's a very strange little bit in the last sort of two pages of the New Mermaids edition where everyone reconciles and Alsemero says, well, that's that. And now I'll be your son to Beatrice Joanna's father. And it all sort of gets neatly wrapped up and there we are. So that's the castle plot. And then you've got the second plot, the hospital plot, which is set in this, well, effectively it's just called a madhouse. Mm. And we're calling it's a hospital plot, where you find out, really there's a parallel plot in which those characters find themselves in similar situations to the people in the castle plot, but react the opposite way. And what we're doing at the moment, going through our investigations, is just thinking, what is the purpose? What's the dramaturgical purpose of this hospital plot? And I think where we've come to is that it almost asks the audience, who do you think is mad? The people who have been sectioned and are in the hospital, staff and patients, or the people in the castle plot? Who is it that's really mad? And we're thinking about how we might put that mad, I'm doing in inverted commas for people listening, mm-hmm. What does that actually mean?
Yes, early modern madness, as opposed to
As opposed, yes, and trying to not be too, thinking about the meaning of the word madness. Mm. Yes, so we've come up with various ideas about how we might represent the hospital plot, because I don't know whether this is interesting to listeners, but there's this thing called pragmatism. So the show can't be any longer than 2 hours for various different reasons with the theatre it's playing. And so we are going to remove most of the text from the hospital plot, but we're exploring why the hospital plot is important and how we might represent it. And so I said at the start of this, Rob, that there's two plots, but there's three worlds. Mm. Because I think of those two as separate worlds, and they almost feel like they jar against each other purposely. But at the same time, lots of productions have done it where actors have doubled. And so you see the actor playing a part in the castle plot and the hospital plot. But I also think the interesting other the world is that of the Catholic Church. Mm. And there's something about it that starts the play. The first scene is in a chapel, or in some editions is as near a chapel, or there's some sense of service. And of course, there's a wedding, with Beatrice Joanna's and Alsemero's wedding. And that's something that I'm really fascinated at the moment, that it feels like the play actually has these three distinct worlds, and that sometimes they collide with each other and sometimes they overlap. And I think that gives us lots of theatrical potential, which is the stuff that really starts getting us excited. But as I say, we're still in the sort of really early dramaturgical stages here and trying to find out as much as we can about the play, but also the playwrights and the context in which they're writing.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, because the play's from somewhere around 1622, I think, is the general dating. And the setting, a Spanish setting, a Catholic setting, you know, that is a very loaded thing for that point in time. We're in the early stages of what's known as the Spanish Match, this attempt by King James to marry his son off and sort of solve many of the problems that that England has had with Spain since, you know, before the Spanish Armada, trying to reconcile two different religious forces. So certainly playwrights are reacting to this, audiences are reacting to this in these years around here. Middleton will come to the climax of this with a play called A Game at Chess in a couple of years' time, which will destroy his career quite effectively. It's the most successful play he ever wrote in one way, in the sense that Game at Chess lasted 9 performances in a row, which was unheard of, because everyone basically went, we've got to keep putting this on because they're going to ban it any second now. There are a lot of plays about Spain or set in Spain, and there's this sort of option there to sort of other and set apart and say, well, if you're going to do something quite nasty, you can sort of set it in Spain, because they're all, you know, there's all sorts of questionable things go on over there. And you talk about it as a thriller, you know, tragedy as thriller. But also, I'm wondering, because you're talking about the chopping off of body parts and burning people alive, is also that, and this is my contention, is that for a modern audience, sometimes tragedy slots into the horror genre as well. You know, if it was a film, you know, it's somewhere between a thriller and a horror, and there's that. And of course it has been filmed both for television and a motion picture in the past, and so it's playing with all sorts of uncomfortable issues, I think, but doing it in a way that is interesting and has enough weight that we can play with those issues. Borderline ableism questions, a question about, you know, someone who has some kind of visual difference in their face, and also the sexual politics of what's going on as well, because there's a lot of questions about how much agency women have in this, and how much they are being controlled, you know, or an attempt to have agency, in a very, you know, Catholic male machismo world where actually you can attempt to have agency, but it may involve having to murder someone under closed doors, and then you might end up in a contract with someone where you actually box yourself into a corner.
And you'll end up dead.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the moral, isn't it? If you're a female character and you try to stride out, there will be consequences.
Mm. And that continued, you know, continues to almost to today with sort of, you know, the erotic thriller genre, which is always, if a woman has sexual agency, she must die at the end of the play or the end of the film. And so it's interesting the way those things overlap with sort of, and that's sort of reacting to your thing about, you know, it being a brand new play. I mean, you know, it has got a modern production history, but it's not necessarily a very deep one. And so, yeah, most of the audiences, I suspect, will be coming to it fresh, or they may be studying it, you know, but they don't necessarily, some people will have seen it, you know, several times.
Yeah.
And I can give you their email addresses.
That's the really exciting thing about it, is that, you know, I love doing, you know, bigger in terms of, and by bigger, I mean sort of more well-known, but you're already, we had this, we did a production of at the beginning of 2023. And what you're really combating is people's emotional connection to a play. And so whenever you investigate anything that they didn't see in the very famous 1963 production that they behold like their firstborn, you're already sort of on the back foot, and you feel like you're in some sort of aggressive argument. And it's really interesting, and it'd be lovely to hear from listeners if they've experienced this as well. There's a feeling of when we do a Marlowe, lots of people are really grateful and just happy it's on. There's a real sort of like, great, and they're up for the debate, they're up for the conversation. I suppose that's because they used to have a good debate about Marlowe and who is Marlowe, etc. But the plays, people will debate them in a really constructive, I don't know, it sort of feels like an inclusive argument that you're having. Whereas there's something about that people feel a real ownership over and offended if you've cut a line or a character. And so what I'm really looking forward to is trying to dust off this play that, yes, some people will know, but I imagine the vast majority of our audiences coming to the Southwark won't know. That's really, really exciting to pull out a play and find a new audience for it. That's a bit of a boost for us all at the moment, rather than thinking about combating people's expectations. Actually, what are the expectations of this play? And then we can find that organically through the process with the company.
I mean, I'm sure there will be a minority who will say, "Well, you've cut the hospital plot."
Yeah, but interestingly, people I know who are sort of, I would say, you know, real sort of diehard early modernists, they sort of already know you're going to do something with it.
Yeah,
and so even people I've met that are very sort of staunch, you must keep the hospital plot, have already also very quickly concede, it does need something doing with it. And you know, and that would be really exciting to see what contemporary actors pull out of it and what to keep and what not to keep. But so even already I'm finding it's a far more constructive, collaborative process than how dare you cut, you should be taken out and flogged.
Yes, I mean, you've got to remember that everybody agrees that their own cuts are great and everybody else's cuts are terrible. That's the basic rule of thumb. So everyone says, oh, you shouldn't cut anything, except when I'm doing it. I made a few trims, but they're all, you know, they're very well thought out. And it's like, that's what everybody does.
Yeah, and that's the alternative, isn't it? You know, what would you rather, a four-hour version? You know, that sounds like a really aggrieved director moaning. It's not. It's just an interesting observation about our connection to the playwrights. And it really has made me really consider that far deeply than I did before, in that actually people are coming with a relationship to some of these plays. I suppose it's going to be less of those people and maybe less sort of adamant, I don't know. But there'll be less of those people coming to change it, which feels refreshing. Mm. And when we did a reading of the play a couple of months ago, none of the actors in the room knew the play before engaging with it for that event. And it really did sing off the page. No one was playing it like an actor they've seen play it. Nobody had seen any of the films. With Changeling, it really was what's on the page, because that's all they had to go off, which I thought was really revelatory. It's great.
You have these pragmatic concerns in terms of, you know, length and also cast size, presumably. I mean, this isn't for, you know, the size of the space you're in will be a limiter on that. So how large a company are you looking at, and how will the doubling and the tech shape be shaped by that?
Yeah, so there's going to be a cast of 10, so it's quite sizable for the space at Southwark. So that will feel big, I think, feel quite epic in its sense, because that's something I'm always drawn to, is sort of the epic as well as the minutiae of the domestic relationships. What we've come up with so far, which by the time the show happens, this may not be what we're doing, but this is very live. This is an exclusive, Rob. This is an exclusive. I know. Yes. This is where we should flash exclusive information. So what we're looking at the moment is representing the hospital plot with song and music. And so, because one of the things that we've been exploring is, one of the great things about the hospital plot is it almost acts like a kind of palate cleanser in the middle of the very, very tense and extreme castle plot. And one thing we found last year when we did Dr. Faustus was that those palate cleansers mean that when you go back to the intense main plot, if you like, in the case of Faustus, going back, you know, rather than the subplot comedy stuff, when you go back to the more sort of intense, extreme stuff, you can go even further, because the audience has the antithesis of the laugh out loud, that sort of crazy, bonkers, weird, theatrical stuff. Then you can just reverse the gear, whoom, and you go straight back into the more sort of straight on serious stuff, if you like. Yeah. And there's a really wonderful thing. And so if we just got rid of the hospital part entirely, you would then just be left with this very intense, serious castle plot. So we're very much looking at the hospital plot as it's this palate cleanser. So we've got a composer at the moment working on writing 6 songs, and the songs are inspired by the text in hospital plots, but are also inspired with whatever the last line was in the castle plot before we go into the song. And they're going to be quite poppy, quite modern. Well, I say poppy and modern. One of them sounds like an Elvis track, which some people listening might not be very modern, but comparatively to 1622. And so the company are going to double as musicians in this band. And the band is called The Patients. And so there's a drum kit with The Patients written on. And so what might appear to the audience as simple act breaks, and there's a need in the play for a couple of those. You know, there's that dodgy bit where DeFlores has to pick up his sword in an act break, and of course in the New Mermaids version it's literally a beat, and all of a sudden has got this sword from someone, you know. So there's just putting these little act breaks in, hopefully will be the palate cleanser. But also what we're going to play with is that actually the play reveals who these people are in the band. And so our production is going to play, instead of it being two separate plots in which actors double, actually we're sort of moving them from a horizontal to a vertical. So i.e. the actors are playing somebody in this madhouse, inverted commas, in the hospital, who are then playing roles within the main plot. So if you imagine horizontally you've got the castle plot and then below it the hospital plot in which actors double up and down in, we're sort of turning that round the other way, and everybody is a patient or a member of staff in this hospital, that then it almost turning into a play within a play, I suppose, is the best way to describe it. So that's what we're investigating structurally at the minute. And the songs event as the play goes on, the songs reveal to the audience, actually, which world are we in? Are we not always in the same world? And you know, earlier, Rob, I said about perhaps the hospital plot is to ask the audience which one you think is mad. Is it the people in the real world or people in the hospital that are mad? Our way of sort of shifting dramaturgically so that we're all in the same world asks the audience, is it the people on stage that are mad, or is the audience mad? And I guess in that respect, the answer is yes and yes, because we're all a bit on some level of madness. That's just being a human. So that's how we think that the worlds might work. And that's something we're working on dramaturgically at the moment. And then we'll have a workshop just before rehearsal to test that, because that's quite a big, bold thing to go into rehearsal with. So we're going to do a bit of exploratory work before we go in and make sure that actually makes sense in performance. Because that's the other thing, isn't it? We're talking about the theories of all of this. But of course, if it doesn't work practically, then what's the point?
Yes, and that's the thing. We're recording this. You know, you've done a certain amount of exploratory work. You've still got a lot more to do. Then you'll go into rehearsals and the show will come together. And as I say, the rule of thumb is always, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And that's also something to say for, you know, anyone who wants to be, you know, oh, the text, this is the play, is that plays don't exist. We have the script for a play, and we have a production of the play, but the play is a fictive thing. It's not actually tangible, and you're going to find out what works, and you know, hopefully you're right, and hopefully most of the audience will agree with you, and that's sort of the game that we play all the time. Is we're making decisions that seem right, and the proof of the pudding is as we do it, going, actually, no, that's a terrible idea. I don't know why I thought of that. Or that's brilliant. Let's run with it. Or something will come out of rehearsals and you go, oh, hang on, that's a line we can take. Do we have time to put it in? And you were saying off camera, you know, there's going to be a lot of playing with this production as you get towards the first performances.
Yes, and I imagine it, as a phrase we've used on a number of productions, actually, it's an 11th hour one, as in things will still be developing, changing, I'm sure, through previews up until press start. And we've got the wonderful luxury of having 7 previews, which is sort of seems a bit excessive, but actually it's fantastic for something like this, because the play also really responds and listens to the audience, you know, this device of the asides, which feels, when we did a reading earlier in the year, it really threw a lot of the actors. What is this weird aside stuff? And and the New Mermaids edition's really good, is it's very prescriptive. It's very clear. This is an aside. This isn't. Which is great for a first read when you get up and you're trying to work it out. And some audiences post COVID might be a bit weird. Oh God, they're talking to me. You know, and maybe sometimes, we found this with Dr. Faustus, actually, some audiences were just not used to being in a theatre actually connecting to the actors, which is this thing that, you know, I remember one actor saying to me, you know, oh, we really are breaking the fourth wall here, aren't we? I said, well, we're not really, because there isn't a fourth wall to start with this drama. You know,
it's not a Pross Arch theatre.
No, and of course, even if you were to do this play in a Pross Arch, they talk directly to the audience. There is no fourth wall, and that didn't exist. So that's a real mind shift actually, particularly if you're a performer that's used to working with the fourth wall or screen TV. So that's really, really interesting observation, how they play that. So they were delightful when the actors went, this just needs to be directed to the audience. And he said, yeah, I think it does. And have a go and try that. We did it. It was fantastic because, of course, what brilliantly happens, and I think this is the genius of Middleton, particularly in the central section, is the audience is given more information than the other character. So, of course, we get this fantastic dramatic irony where we're one beat ahead. And it becomes funny because we already know what, and it reveals so much about them as well. You know, particularly to Flores and Beatrice Joanna, on some level, and I have seen this in performance where they're very 2D, just the one, you know, that sort of just that very one thing all the time, sort of wooden, if you like, a bit flat. But actually, I think the asides reveal something entirely different about them, that they don't want to perform and project to the other character, but they are prepared to invest in the audience. And so people listening to this might go, sure, of course, we know that's what asides are for. But the journey that we've been on is that actually a lot of performers are out of practice with that sort of thing. And lots of performers are coming to it new. And so my thinking is there'll be lots of audiences that are, particularly if you haven't seen a play like this for the last 5-6 years, which actually with the pandemic could be, you know, could be at least 3 years people have seen this sort of drama. So it's been really fascinating just at the initial stages that we've done so far. But I think we'll learn so much from that preview audience where those actors do absolutely connect with the audience. And so there are going to be things we don't and can't learn about the play until the audience is there. And again, I know I keep banging on about Dr. Faustus, which we did last year. But that's exactly what we found. The actor Jamie O'Neill, who played Dr. Faustus, that opening piece of tech, that opening speech, that opening conversation was absolutely pivotal to the rest of the performance when he's going through all of the different studies he could continue with or carry on with, explaining, communicating. And I think that's the joy of these plays, is the writers know and the actors know, the audience know that they're actors. There's just something wonderful. And again, this might sound very obvious, but I say this quite often in workshops and rehearsals and when I'm teaching, that there's a real wonderful honesty in that I know you're an actor and you know I'm the audience. And that's what a play is. Let's go. Rather than the pretense of I'll pretend you're not there. And these things you have no bearing on these things at all, you know. And I think that's something that I've really longed for after the pandemic, is going back into a shared space, into a shared experience where it feels like it could only happen with the audience being here. Because without the audience, it's a rehearsal. So it'll be very 11th hour. And that's not, you know, I'm not meaning that to say, you know, panic anybody, particularly anyone on the production. Oh God, it's going to all happen at the last minute. But there are certain things we probably won't learn until we've got the good folk in the audience, which I think is really exciting.
And the thing is, this was also, to a degree, an authentic practice of the period. So by the 17th century, there is effectively a reworking process that goes on between the first performance and the second performance and maybe even the third performance. At the first performance, I say by about the time this play is going on, you know, you've got accounts that, you know, the audience are paying a premium for a first night by that point. And it's there basically to say, There is a feedback process where you find out what the, and quite an active feedback process, I believe, where, you know, they are quite vocal about what they do and do not like, and then there may be tweaks between that and the next showing a couple of weeks later, and of course the author is hoping that it'll get to a third or fourth performance because that's when they get a bonus. As well, for some companies, it would say by the time you're into the 17th century, there is a much more organised process as to how shows are sort of managed and go forward in the repertoire. Because of course, originally it's performing as part of a repertoire, and you've got a bit of time between that first performance and the next performance of, you know, a week or two later, to, if it didn't work, to sort it out. And if it still doesn't work, you may give it another go and try and sort it out. And if it's still not working, then it's junked and it doesn't necessarily stay in the repertoire. And the author doesn't get a bonus payment. So there's real fierce competition. And of course, then later on it gets printed. And that's usually the text that we get. So, you know, this is a play that would have already undergone a certain kind of workshopping process. It may have gone out perfectly fine the first performance. And everyone, yeah, that's good. Straight in the repertoire. Take that for the king. Yeah, it would be great on tour. And it might have worked that way.
Going back to your point about the play, you know, it's the script and then there's a production. And so you might argue, blimey, this, you know, it's an old play. Why are you still trying to work it out? And I suppose it's because it's what it means right here, right now, with that group of people in that theatre at that time. Mm. So, yes, it's very, very good. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. It is a very, I think it's a cracking play, a cracking read, literally a page turner when you're reading it. And of course, when I'm reading plays at home, I try and read it up on my feet and out loud. Much to the neighbour's distress, but so you still get that sort of the performative element of it. You need to hear it out loud, but it really, that reading was a page turner, really gripping. But of course, you're still not going to really know the full impact of that, because the audience in September, October 2023 are different from even an audience in 2022 compared to 2021. You know, just audiences, it's a live, living, breathing thing. So people might be a bit sort of hashtag baffled at kind of, crikey, like, haven't we got this script down yet? But I think plays are living, breathing things. And particularly this with the asides and being really conscious of an audience, it will have that different energy every performance, which is going to be fantastic to watch through the run.
So I'd say we were talking earlier about, you know, this is by Thomas Middleton and William Rowley. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, what reasons why some playwrights or plays, you know, are more popular than others, why they land or not. Because I don't think anyone really outside of real specialism know William Rowley at all. They may have encountered him as a co-writer, and he did collaborate with a lot of writers. He certainly collaborates with Thomas Middleton a lot. So you can be forgiven for not knowing who is. But Thomas Middleton is definitely about, you know, there has been a collected works looking at the extent of his corpus, as it were. And he didn't really get a collected works in his day. As you know, some playwrights did, you know, Johnson, Fletcher, etc. Beaumont, Fletcher, rather. But I don't think Middleton ever really got that until the beginning of the 21st century when the collected works were released. And you know, he wrote a lot, did Thomas Middleton. I mean, collaboratively as well as a solo playwright. So there's this huge amount of work, which used to be performed a lot more. I think that one of the big problems we have in the 21st century is the corpus that gets performed has narrowed. You know, the big sellers are the big sellers, and they are the sellers, and they are what sell, and everything else sort of has fallen by the wayside. Even within the sometimes the wider, you know, corpus that we know, you know, there used to be more opportunities. We used to have rep. We used to have television that used to do plays. The Changeling was done. Helen Mirren was in it on television. So you know, in the 70s, I think Middleton and maybe you know, this play had a much wider audience than they do today. And sort of, that's part of my job, is to try and build that audience up online and try and get more people to know about their work. That's not really a question. That's just a sort of thing. I don't know if you've got thoughts on that.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's, so when you sort of drill down, what is it? It's about money, I think. And they're expensive. You know, pretty much 60% of our budget has to be found beyond box office. So that essentially for us is Arts Council money. That may well be, we have a Friends and Angels scheme where people can support our work. It's incredibly expensive just because of the number of people who are involved in it. And so I suppose when we had a repertory system, you would have that company of actors. So that's not an extra expense. That just is the expense of the salaries of the actors. So, of course, you could then explore these. And, of course, the wonderful thing about these plays, then, they're out of copyright. So they actually become really economical to do. And so an artistic director of a regional producing house could then go, well, let's go over to the literary department, pick the play off the shelf. If it's out of rights, actually, it's relatively accessible because we're already paying the actors weekly wage. I don't think the other thing is now it's narrowed. I think it's also about the plays that bigger name actors want to do. Mm. So I suppose part of it is, I thought about this quite a lot when there was a production of Henry V at the Donmar Warehouse in London. And I thought it was really interesting that Kit Harington was playing Henry. And I thought, I really would love to know what that conversation was. Was it going to Kit saying, what would you like to do? Or was that the it had been programmed and had said, oh, Kit, what about being Henry V? And I thought, God, you know, if ever I'm in that position of running a building, wouldn't it be a bit more interesting to say to someone like Kit Harington, hey, come and do some theatre? Now, I know you might, you know, you might not know this Edward II thing, or you might not know this Changeling, or whatever the other early modern plays might be. I know you won't do it, but actually it's cracking part for you. And maybe the director's, part of the director's role and the venue's role then is to introduce them to these bigger name actors who then give these plays that exposure that the actor might not be so aware of. Because maybe they don't all want to be Henry V, and maybe they shouldn't all be Henry V. But is it about something about those roles that really appeal to actors? Because they, you know, I've been talking to an actor recently who's always wanted to be Othello. And when I've asked him, actually, why do you want to play Othello? The answer's been, well, because it's Othello, you know, it's a huge role. And I was like, but let's just drill down a bit into who Othello is and what we're saying by doing a production of Othello, you know, sort of just drill down a bit. And actually part of it is the myth or the mystique, or it's the benchmark, or it's the goal, or it's, you know, why on earth would you want to play Hamlet? Oh my God, all those lines to learn.
And it's this thing. I think one of the reason why Middleton sometimes loses out is that a lot of his plays are ensemble. That though they do have good parts, they don't have the star vehicle part. Mm. I mean, one of the reasons why Faustus continues to do quite well is you've got two really good leads.
Yeah.
And then there's everybody else. and you know you can drill it down to a relatively small cast if you really are there with the pruning shears, you can do it with three people. Whereas you know other ensemble plays they're ensemble plays. They're a relatively balanced cast. Mm. I think one of the big question: why do plays go chosen? Who chooses those plays? Why do we choose these plays? Well, sometimes it's economics, but sometimes, just straightforwardly, a director wants to do this play. That is the reason the play is put on. Or this actor wants to do this play, so they put on the play, because they are big enough names in of themselves that they will sell a percentage of the tickets. And it's educating artists about these plays and saying, look, you know, you might not do this play tomorrow, but if you really love it, you're going to do it in the next 5 years, aren't you? And changing the it's not just building an audience, it's also building an artistic audience, as it were.
Yeah, building a relationship so that actually, you know, you could go back to that Donmar example, Max Webster, the director, and Kit, you know, might have a relationship now where hopefully they can be reading other things that they go, do you know, we had a good go at that. Let's think about something that's a little bit more off-piste. Because I also think there's quite a lot of kudos, I suppose there's a lot of risk, but there's quite a lot of kudos in being that production that rediscovers this play and brings the attention of it because of the prestige of the director or the actor. Because there's a risk in playing Henry V, right? Because you're just going to be compared to all the other Henry V's.
Hmm.
To be fair to using Kit Harington as an example, he did do Dr. Faustus as well, you know, in a pretty off-the-wall, sort of batshit crazy version.
Hmm.
Yes, I think that's part of it. And yes, maybe then, but I just think on your ensemble point, wouldn't it be cracking that you get those lead actors all in the Changeling? I mean, those three main roles, you could have three stonking three leading actors rather than a one sort of horse billing. You've got you could have three. Yeah, you know, I also think of other later early modern plays, you know, thinking like The Duchess of Malfi and The White Devil and all of those sorts of things. You go, God, there's some corkers in here.
Mm.
And the play doesn't then have to sit on your back alone. It can sit on a collective. But, you know, I would say that because I love ensemble work. I much prefer working as an ensemble than with one person.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It starts building. The other thing is also, you know, when you need a company of a certain size, that means you need to be in a space of a certain size, which means you have to, you know, so even if you had all the money in the universe backing you, you still need to fill a lot of seats because the space you're going to be in will have a lot of seats. And if you can't sell those seats, then there's no point doing it. Even if we were subsidized to the hilt, there's nothing worse than going out and playing to, you know, three people and a dog in a 200 seat of theatre or something, because it's just no fun. I mean, that's sort of, I say, why we started digitally, is because you can build a bigger audience digitally. who hopefully will come to shows. That's the plan. And we'll see what audience we can build that way. I mean, obviously, there are more diverse audience in the sense that some of them can't commute to see a show. They won't be local. But you take the rough with the smooth if you get more people in.
And you've just talked about developing audience, but also that artistic audience. But I also think building a long is quite difficult. I mean, we're sort of obsessed with buildings in British theatre.
Yeah.
But I can sort of see why. Because actually having a place where they know you're going to be all the time actually is sort of reassuring to audiences. And we've had first-hand experience of this by being a resident in a building. People know where you are and then start to build up trust. So when you do fling them that play they haven't heard of, that if you've built that trust, they'll give it a go. Mm. You've just got to scale that up to a number that, as you say, you don't want to play to one man and his dog, however important the one man and his dog is. Mm. You'd rather it be full. Mm. But I'm pretty convinced there's something about a longer-term relationship with your audiences as well as your artists that then means you can take those risks over time. Mm. Which I think in the turnover of artistic directors that we've got in the UK at the minute, for various reasons, actually that's quite a short-term relationship. And again, I think that goes back to money and being able to think long-term, but also build a strategy where you are going to, something isn't going to be commercially, financially advantageous, but actually it buys you all these other things.
So sometimes we hear, when we're talking about what we might do with a play, when we've done an exploring session and say, well, what might we do with it? And someone will say, well, you know, it's not going to be, you're only going to do it once or whatever, or, you know, it's only going to have, you know, so you should just do it as the text says. And I say, great. But we're not going to just do it once. This is what we do. We just keep doing the plays again and again and again because that's our raison d'etre. And we're going to, you know, we record a very bland, complete text recording before we then, and we release that before we go into the, you know, edited version that we think someone will enjoy listening to. You know, there's the sort of the intellectual exercise, and then there's the actual, okay, what would a casual listener who has no idea what this is, we'll listen to, we'll see it. And it's the same thing with a theatre production, is they're saying, well, look, yes, we could sit down and we could do a lovely reading of the text, and that there is an audience for that, actually. And that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. But if you want to do a production, well, we're going to have to do some, you know, we're going to have to make it our production.
And that is a consideration. I mean, it'd be really interesting to hear from other directors on this, but it is a consideration when you're doing a play that's more rarely performed, you do feel a bit like, oh, well, you know, it not people only might see one of these in their life, maybe two. So, oh, I do have to be a bit more careful because I don't want to misrepresent the play. Whereas if it's, you know, I feel I do feel a bit more cavalier with Shakespeare because it's okay, there'll be another one along soon. Mm. You know, and I feel as a director, you can be a bit more, I've certainly felt that. I felt that you can be a bit more bold with plays because it's okay, there's another one coming along. But actually, I could turn people off Marlowe if I keep getting it wrong. Mm. There's sort of an obligation, I suppose.
Yes, there is a good example of that, the Night of the Burning Pestle, which had a very bad production about 15, 20 years ago. I forget precisely where and when. It was a very bad production. And it was a play that had sort of ticked along and done quite, you know, popped up every so often because it is a very funny play. It's very, 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 very good. But it's a tricky play and it can bite you if you don't get it right. And this production didn't. And it sort of killed the play for 10 years. I mean, it really did. Everyone just sort of went, oh, well, this play, it's dead. And the Globe revived it. And everyone, oh, no, it is funny. Oh, good. And I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but it wasn't a good show. The one I saw many years ago. It's sometimes that can happen. But I say, it's trying to create multiplicity, trying to create all the different tendrils that are out there so that you can experience it in so many different ways. I'm sure we could continue chatting all day, but I think we should probably work our way to a conclusion. So in the run-up, this is a little plug for what we're doing. We have our exploring sessions every week on Zoom. We'll be starting again in September, September into October. We will be focusing on plays either by Middleton or William Rowley. So there will be a link in the show description if you want to join us to discover some other plays by the playwrights to give you a bit of a chance to get your head in the game before the production itself. And in fact, there may be some additional bonus head-in-the-game material on the Changeling before the production goes up. I'm hoping we'll be able to pop in again and see how the production process is going before the show goes up. But for the listeners who are listening at the moment, in this moment in time, in the summer of 2023, plug your show, please, and where can they get tickets and all the things that will be linked in the show description?
Best place to go is our website, which is just Google Lazarus Theatre Company. Lazarus is in Risen from the Dead. And all the info's there, all the information about the play, but also what we do as a company, if people are interested in any of the other projects that we're doing, productions or projects, is all listed there, along with links to snap up your tickets. And we first previews is September the 28th, and we run through to October the 28th. So there's 5 weeks, so plenty of opportunity for people to come down and experience this cracking thriller.
And yes, for those listening in the future, that is September into October 2023. So
well, so far, Rob, I mean, it could extend. Who knows?
Who knows? Look down the feed for more information. But yes, all those links will be in the show description, and hopefully we will see you there. Certainly, myself and various members of the team will be coming along to watch the show, hopefully across the course of its run as well, to see how it changes, because I'm quite keen actually to catch an early preview and then pop in later in the run and see what's what, because I'm always interested in that process. Till then, until hopefully another episode covering The Changeling, all that remains is to thank my wonderful guest for being wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And goodbye.